Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Why do you keep looking at me?
No, I'm not. You know what? You're right. I'm sorry. It's just... You look so much like... Someone I used to know.
Someone other than the girl you just professed your love for? Well, aren't you the Romeo?
Far from it, believe me.
I don't believe you, by the way. You may have Richard fooled, but you can't really expect me to believe that you, a British woman, and a Chinese man are all members of the United States military. Who are you, and what are you doing on our island?
You want to know who I am? I'm your best chance at disarming that bomb.
Right then. Disarm it.
Is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recap, talking Season 5, Episode 3, Jughead. I'm Josh Wigler. I'm joined here by Mike Bloom, and the two of us are running around wondering where the heck we can find Efren Salonga.
Yeah, but I'm also looking for Cole Sprouse. I was promised Jughead.
Yeah.
I got nary a sign of Archie. No Betty, no Veronica. I guess if we want to call Charles Winmore the Goblin King, we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I the name does not guarantee a little weirdo in a crown hat showing up, Josh.
Is that the most disappointing part about Jughead, that there are no, as far as I can recall, there are no hamburgers in this episode?
Right, exactly. Nobody's chowing down. No one went to high school, at least not in this episode, despite the fact that we're dealing with time travel. I mean, look, disappointment is a word that doesn't even get close to the vicinity of Jughead. That being said, I know that some people really put that episode up there. It's not that I don't, but I think there are certain things that maybe I don't enjoy about it as much as I do, arguably, the two episodes that precede it.
Interesting. The two that we've already discussed.
I mean, listen, I'll come right out and say it and be explicit about it, because I mentioned it before. Josh, I know that you've sort of said one of your Lost hangups and one of the reasons why you're not a huge fan of Season 4 is because of the Michael stuff.
Yep.
Here's one of my Lost hot takes. I am not a fan of Desmond in Season 5 and 6.
I don't think that that's a supremely spicy take. I think that that's fair. Well, I think what really happens is, like, they kind of lose the plot on him. Like, they only have, like, a tiny bit more to do with Desmond.
Yeah, you know? and so that's the thing, is that maybe it's just me saying, as I talked about in There's No Place Like Home, like, you really had a point to the off-ramp, right? You had an opportunity to say he found his love, the stories end, the end, to quote Desmond all the way back from when we first met him. And there are times that we bring him back, specifically in this episode, that to me at least are kind of like Jughead's favorite food, a little bit of a nothing burger.
Sure.
To me. I think that while I love Henry and Cusick and the season six element that he, the role that he plays at least is interesting in the Flash sideways stuff, bringing him into the main plot, I think, leaves a little less to be desired from a character that essentially was batting 1,000 up to this point, even in something like Catch-22, when the flashback is maybe not necessarily as huge and fun as everything else that surrounds it. I don't know. I think there's a lot of stuff on Island that is so, so fun, especially as we talked about last week. They really put this bomb in the earth that serves as a seed to plant that's going to germinate and grow into much bigger plot points later on. But I couldn't help, honestly, and think like, okay, yeah, this is a fun episode, but there is a little bit of an albatross here. And unfortunately, it's in the form of Desmond Hume and his quest around Great Britain.
I think that's fascinating, and I don't think it is an unfair take. I think that there are certainly aspects of that take that I agree with. I think that his story becomes pretty slim from this point forward. The best of Desmond Hume, I think, is behind him. Certainly mm-hmm. the constant is the high point. But there's definitely good Desmond stuff coming up. I think for me, Jughead, again, we keep talking about like centricities for these episodes, and I think it's misleading because like you're inclined to think this is a Desmond episode, but why isn't it a Faraday episode?
It really should be.
If anything, I think it is a Faraday episode. I don't think that it is a Desmond episode. Off island, Desmond is leading the action, but on island, Faraday is. So I think that they're, you know, it's the constant and the variable, you know, these two people across time working in tandem with one another, but it's Daniel Faraday's history that is very much the star of the show. So maybe that changes the calculus a little bit if you view Jughead as a Faraday episode rather than a Desmond episode, which is how I view it. Mm-hmm. I think that Jeremy Davies and Daniel Faraday so front and center in this one. We're getting, you know, different iterations of Daniel's parents in this episode. We are setting up, really, in a meaningful way, not just the end of the season and the inciting, wait for it, incident of so much of Lost with the detonation of the Jughead, but also setting up Daniel's future demise. Like, there's just a lot that's going on here in terms of that snake eating its own tail quality that season five possesses that I really, really enjoy. With that being said, I do agree that I think that there are people who talk about Jughead as, like, an elite top tier 4.2 episode of Lost. It's not for me.
Yeah.
I think it's excellent. I think it's very, very, very good. But I think the thing about Jughead more than anything, and this is another reason why I just think season five is just like the batting average is substantial, is because like it's just got so many thought starters. It's very provocative. Mm. It is more a provocative, interesting to consider episode than it is like an exhilarating one. In some regards, I think it's it feels like a slow episode. It's a chess pieces episode in a really big way. Like without this episode, the finale of this season makes no sense. So
right.
We're really positioning the end game of season five here at the start. But I kind of love that structurally, Mike. I think that even like in this episode, the conclusion is relative, like it feels unsatisfying by design. Locke finally gets to Albert, but not until the end of the episode. And they're just starting to have the conversation. And he does do something remarkably meaningful, but mm-hmm. it requires some thought to really process and understand why the end of the episode for Locke is an enormous deal. But the way that it's presented, the way that it feels both for John and for us, the audience, is like really frustrating. And like,
yeah.
We just got like, you know, pushed and we're in Eggtown, baby, go to shell. Where I think in reality, it's actually rather dazzling what happens at the end of the episode. So this structural stuff of season five, where in many ways I think it's like designed to be somewhat unsatisfying, I think that works for me, but it does. I know that it works for me, but I do think that it can make watching some of the episodes like maybe not as like electric as certainly like that that like 1-2-3 punch of the season four finale with Shape of Things to Come in there for good measure.
Yeah, lots of punches being thrown and not just Benjamin Linus's way. That's the interesting thing about season five as well, is that there's certainly going to be some more action-packed stuff. That's really the incident, I think, is actually like pretty propulsive in that regard, especially once they get that mission with the aforementioned Jughead. But I think because we talk about how cohesive of a season five is, it allows them to sort of sit in the back pocket and slow play these things a bit more, which is really interesting, right? I don't know if in previous seasons of Lost, if the show would have the forethought to introduce Jughead here for it to really come to prominence in the last 3 to 4 episodes of the finale, right? Like a dozen episodes later. That is really cool. And I really like, I mean, I think on paper, I like seeing, OG versions of these older characters. I think we'll talk a little about it, maybe some other hot takes that I might throw out there. It's also interesting because this is sort of like, we're jumping through time, and this is one of our first genuine stops in a time period, and then we're out of it. Like, we're going to really sit in the 70s for a long portion of time.
Sure.
But the 50s is kind of like the warm-up act, right? This is the first time we're going to spend an entire episode in a time period. And while it ultimately serves to plant that bomb into the ground, the 70s are going to be much more of the focus. So that being said, I definitely have more appreciation for this episode with everything in hindsight. Not to skip too far ahead to our ratings, I do have it slightly above the lie, but I agree with what you said. First and foremost, I will not yuck anyone's yum. If you want to give this a 4, a 4.1, even a 4.2, it's not there for me personally, but I think I can ascribe to what we said last week, and that, like, I think this is a very solid episode of Lost with the added little sprinkles on top of that sundae of really deliciously setting up some big elements. I mean, Daniel Faraday, that intro clip was Daniel Faraday talking with the person that's going to kill him.
It's his mom.
Yeah.
So add that to it, you know, like, so it's really, really, really layered. I like it. I think, like, it is, it is much like Shrekmond, Mike, an onion, this episode.
It has layers.
You know, it's got layers. So we'll get into it. Of course, this is Down the Hatch. We are in season 5. We are releasing these episodes early to the patrons of post-show recaps. As this podcast is dropping in the main Down the Hatch feed, it is May 28th. You are just around the corner from June 1st. Perfect time to sign.
Just around the river bend.
Just the perfect time to sign up for the Patreon program at Post Show Recaps at patreon.com/postshowrecaps. First of the month is always the right time to sign up if you haven't. The best time was yesterday, was right now. Next time, June 1st. So consider signing up. You'll get Down the Hatch early, certainly this season, as we are doing some time travel antics. You get those episodes on Wednesdays. patreon.com/postshowrecaps. That's at the $5 patron podcast level. Support your podcasters. We really appreciate anybody who is able to help us out. On top of that, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsors for this episode of Post Show Recaps. Those are friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. I bet it could be hard work. You know it's easy bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing too because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Mike Bloom, you got anything you want to get off your chest before we hop into Jughead?
Well, let's start actually with our going forth into the jungle, because there's some interesting notes with regards to season one in this episode, Josh. Maybe that's another reason why this is such a unique episode to me. First, it's directed by Rod Holcomb. And if you're wondering who the hell is that, it's been a hot second since we've heard Rod Holcomb being mentioned on this podcast, Josh. Rod Holcomb, the last Lost episode he directed, Hearts and Minds, season one, episode 13. I'm not sure for what particular reason Rod decided to come back for this particular episode, but it's interesting that you bring back a season one director for this because, according to Lostpedia, A, this is the first episode in which none of the Oceanic Six appear, and on top of that, Josh, B, only two of the characters featured in this episode originated in season one, John Locke and Sawyer. It's a wild thing to look at that you don't even notice, and I think it's a sign of how, you know, we talked about how Lost has done a really great job of fleshing out these characters, that it's not necessarily like we moved on completely from that season one group, but it's one of these opportunities that you sort of look around and say, did we sort of like build the ship of Theseus here in Jughead, where we have Locke and Sawyer doing stuff, but for the most part, everyone is someone who did not crash on Oceanic Flight 815?
Yeah, we have changed. Is it still Lost without Oceanic 815 is a fair question. I vote yes. It is late Lost. You mm-hmm. know, it is late stage Lost, but it is indeed Lost. So welcome back, Rod Holcomb. There's no Boone to speak of in this episode. I think Jughead a superior episode to Hearts and Minds, even though I think we enjoyed Hearts and Minds.
Yeah, well, listen, I don't think that's saying much. Like, oh, yeah, I think Jughead really is superior to the episode where Boone and Shannon do it with the Sydney Opera House in the background. That's sort of damning with faint praise.
We liked it, though. We enjoyed it
more than I think, but yeah, I agree. I think that however the means that he returned here, Rod Holcomb is just happy he didn't have to deal with, like, semi-incest. Well, actually, maybe he did. Not incest, but in the manners of family trees getting gnarled. He gets to continue to do that in this episode.
Yeah, families are roughing each other up once again in this episode of Lost. Let's get into it. We begin in the Philippines, Mike, with Desmond running all over the place, screaming the words, Efren Salonga! Efren Salonga! Which is apparently the name of the local doctor, but I just love that. Like, Efren Salonga! Like, that sounds like a curse.
No, it sounds like a Tagalog phrase, right? Like, oh, when you're saying Efren Salonga, it's sort of like it means no worries. You know, that Desmond's attitude off the island, no more worries.
Is Efren Salonga the opposite of Hakuna Matata? It means, much
all
like
worries.
Vaughn would say, some worries.
All worries. Some worries. All worries right now. Like, help, my wife is bleeding. Efren Salonga. Also, we're traveling through time and there's a bomb that's leaking. That's maximum Efren Salonga. That's Efren Salonga Salonga. That's how much Salonga's going on right now.
Is this, Mike, the key, though, to understanding, like, the first half of Season 5, who the Centricity really does belong to? Because it does open with Desmond, and beyond the fact that it opens with Desmond, this is technically a Desmond flashback. This takes place not long after the Oceanic Six have returned.
Oh, yeah, they knocked so many boots. So Desmond wasn't wearing shoes when they crashed into the ocean, so.
The boots are gone. They've been knocked. This is like 9 months later, post-Oceanic Six arrival. So, like, Hurley is close to getting into the mental hospital. I don't know where Saeed and Nadia are at this point, but it's probably not looking great. Meanwhile, life and death, right? So Desmond and Penny are going to have baby Charlie.
Look at little baby Charlie.
I love little baby Charlie's hair.
Oh, of course Desmond would sort of like let this kid grow his hair out, right? My wife is someone who does not necessarily go for that. She is sort of like an antagonist in the musical Hair in that regard. In fact, yesterday she gave my son a buzz cut and then gave me one on top of that because we are an anti-long hair household, I suppose. But I think
get rid of it.
The curls really work on young Charlie here. Interesting name, because I love the reference to Charlie Pace, but also Charles is the name of Penny's dad too.
Yeah,
so like,
and so I think about that. I think about like what that conversation looked like, because like we're gonna name him after the worst guy, but also the best guy. And what I like about it, and what I think that baby Charlie represents, is this idea of we contain multitudes. Like there are no heroes, there are no villains. I mean, there are definitely villains. There's definitely some heroes too. But everybody has, the potential, at the start to be something different, to, you know, choose your own destiny, make your own luck, as Hurley would say. So I like this idea that like, without Charlie, Desmond and Penny never found each other again. And so in Charlie's death, Desmond honors him in life, and it's also like further defiance of Charles Widmore. It's like saying to Charles Widmore, like, yeah, your grandson's name is Charlie, but he's not named after you. I think it's such a middle finger that I really appreciate.
Well, not to mention, though, I mean, Charles Widmore does begrudgingly contribute a little bit, right? Going back to the constant, Widmore does give Desmond Penny's address to be able to sort of, like, complete the loop, as it were. So that's an interesting sort of tie-in, too, that as much as we talk about Charlie, Pace is, of course, directly responsible for Desmond and Penny reuniting. Charles Widmore doesn't necessarily function in complete opposition to the two of them. He does partially, but he contributes in some ways as well. But yeah, it's got to be a nice dig, too, for maybe Desmond to you know, tell Charles Widmore finally, yeah, we named our child after you, but it's actually not after you. It's about a guy that we actually liked who has the same name as you, you a-hole. His name isn't even Charles. We called him Charlie. It's not even a nickname.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
I will say this birth... I mean, that's the other thing as well, is that they sort of, like, blaze through this birth in a manner of speaking. You know, I unfortunately, I didn't feel, as much as I love Desmond and Penny, I didn't feel as much with Penny giving birth as I did with Claire or even Son. Maybe it's because we got to live through those characters' pregnancies for a good amount of the term, as opposed to like, all right, bing, bang, boom, we're starting with Penny giving birth, that you're like, oh, okay, sure. Yeah, their little family's grown from 1 to 2 to 3. It's not bad, necessarily, but I would say if we're power ranking the births of these Lost characters, Penny might be the bottom, if partially due to the fact that I don't know if Efren Salonga washed his hands before he was handling that kid.
Yeah, just to be clear, we are not power ranking the births on Lost. It's not a thing that we're going to do. But the baby is born. The baby is here. Desmond and Penny, they still love each other so, so much. And we get to see that even though they love each other so much, they cannot necessarily escape some measure, Mike, of personal conflict. As we jump back into the present, Desmond is with baby Charlie on the roof of their ship that they live on.
Our mutual friend.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit of some contentiousness is going to break out here. Let's listen in sound number one.
Look, right out there, beyond where you can see, there's an island, and it's a very special island. I left it a long time ago. Never thought I'd see it again. It's called Great Britain, and the most beautiful part of the island, Scotland. That's where your daddy's from. There's mountains and glens and monsters and deep lochs, and that's where your mummy and daddy fell in love.
It's also where he broke her heart.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd leave that wee bit out now.
You also left out the bit about his grandfather. The man who sent a boat to the island to kill all Daddy's friends.
We'll be in and out. You'll never know we're here, Penny.
Don't underestimate him, Desmond. If he finds out we're here, I don't know what he'll do.
This has nothing to do with your father, Penny. We are here because of Daniel Faraday. Look, he told me that everyone on that island is in danger, and I am the only one that can help them. I have to do this, Penny.
But he doesn't.
He doesn't, but he does. He does. He does, because what's he supposed to do? He knows it. It's not a dream. It's a memory. He feels it differently. Desmond is unique in time and space, and so he knows that this happened. What's he supposed to do? Just totally ignore it?
No, I mean, I know. I don't mean, like, from an emotional perspective. I mean from a literal perspective, because Eloise Hawking's already in L.A. He's going to show up there and be like, "Ah, don't trust her, Jack." And he's like, "All right, I will." And then that's it.
That is totally fair. That is 100% fair. That is effectively where this goes. Where this effectively goes is, like, Desmond goes through Oxford, finds out that Eloise is in L.A., goes to L.A., delivers the message from Faraday, but it really adds nothing because, like, the gang is already on their way back. And so he says, don't trust her, and then he leaves. And then he gets shot a little while later. And that's about it for Desmond in season five. So if the issue is like this is a relatively needless storyline as it pertains to Desmond, I've got no problem with that, and I think I agree with it.
Yeah.
And I'm a big proponent of like, you know, you can get rid of a character and not have them come back without killing them. Like, that's, I've talked about, you know, how I wish that had been what they did with the aforementioned Eloise, young Eloise mentions this to Faraday in the opening clip that we listened to at the start of this, the U.S. military, which I imagine must be a Michael, because that is a plant. I mentioned this with Michael, that, like, they didn't have to bring him back.
Right.
And they certainly really rush-jobbed him when they did. Like, could they have just let Desmond and Penny go? Was that not an option? I guess, like, the hanging thread there is Ben's threat to kill Penny. So, like, that is needs in, like, underlined quotes, bold, italics, to be addressed. But other than that, is there not a version of Lost that ends without seeing Desmond again, let alone even seeing him? I mean, like, the whole thrust of the final season probably has to be very, very different.
Yeah.
If you don't bring Desmond back. But I think that there's a world where, like, maybe it was a little more courageous if they choose to, like, leave Desmond behind in season four, and some people do get to leave, and some people aren't bound by, like, this ironclad destiny and do get to make their own luck separate from this thing, had Desmond not suffered enough. So I understand your frustration with it, and I don't altogether disagree with it.
Yeah, so that's actually what you just mentioned is maybe one of my other hang-ups with it. I mean, again, Lost was one of the first TV dramas I ever got into. I was a very, very late bloomer, pun unintended, to TV dramas, because I feel such dread for a lot of characters and dark situations. And I can understand why people get enjoyment out of that. It's one reason why I personally hate horror movies. But again, I'm not yucking people's yum. I can understand why people like it. I think that's another reason why I'm not really caught on to Desmond in seasons 5 and 6, is because of scenes like that where, just like you said, I'm like, you had your happy ending. Like, I really don't want you to go back. I really don't want this to be, oh, Desmond had his moment in the sun, but then he gets dragged back into the dark. And that's not what happens in this instance. Unfortunately, it is going to happen for a short portion of time in season 6. But I remember in that finale, Josh, in the end, being like, oh my God, like, Desmond's going to die here, and he has a family. And so when Jack tells him, like, go, you have a family, I hooted and hollered, basically. Yeah. Because I thought that was what's going to happen, that, oh no, despite Desmond finally escaping and getting this triumphant story of reuniting and finding love, he's going to have to get dragged kicking and screaming back onto the island, and then he's going to die there and leave his kid behind. So maybe it was because I kept foreseeing some sort of tragedy happening that these scenes always kind of, like, put me on edge. That being said, I actually really like this first scene. Storyline aside, I love the rug pull with the opening monologue, right? Talking about the mysterious island. Also, if we're talking about call forwards, really great call forward here, talking about how Scotland or a particular island has monsters that turn out to be deep locks or something like that. I mean, Look what's going to happen several episodes from now. But
there's a lot of clever writing this season that, like, I buy, like, all of our, like, is this a monster jokes aside, like, that is, like, a monster reference.
Yeah.
Like, for sure. Like, because they have to have season 5 relatively tightly mapped in order for any of this to work.
Well, I think because they did 16 straight, right? I don't know what the filming schedule is, but you can't really write that much on the fly. You have to know at least the big twist. So I would imagine that, the monsters and locks thing has to be an explicit reference to what's going to happen.
All right, so let's keep going. On the island, we've got Faraday, Miles, Charlotte, a couple of additional gawkers, all of whom are on their way to the creek.
Wow, a couple survived, but not for long. They lasted maybe like 12 hours after their brethren and sistren.
Yeah, so Charlotte's got a headache. It's getting worse. She's getting double vision, and she keeps saying to Faraday, "Why do you look so worried? Do you know what's going on here?" And Faraday's like, "No."
I mean, listen, this is a great Daniel Faraday episode. Daniel Faraday, just answer the damn question, okay? Well, she keeps asking you, "Do you know what's wrong with me?" You can at least say yes. Maybe don't extrapolate further, but just don't completely skirt and give a non-answer entirely.
Correct. And I also will say, like, I really don't love the Faraday and Charlotte stuff.
Yeah, that's another thing is that I know that they really try to amp that up this episode, right? With, like, because I'm here with the woman I love and I'm not going to blow up the island. Maybe just because there was so little fed to us. These are relatively new characters that it's like, again, I'm
it
not
particularly
invested. It just
feels like
invested.
A big shift from who Charlotte was last season. Like, you know, we didn't get a lot from her, but, like, for her to, like, now be, like, totally, like, completely wowed by Daniel just feels off. It just doesn't feel right.
Maybe in her new adult state, she's becoming a little more softened to Daniel Faraday's wooing.
Yeah.
So she's not feeling great is the point. Maybe we're not feeling so great about what's going on here. Anyway, meanwhile, we've got Miles, who's got a little bit of an attitude problem because he thinks that no one else being at the creek means they're all dead. But he also maybe is on the money because he sees this tripwire. He's a little delayed reaction. He responds so slowly that these poor gawkers just get wrecked.
Yeah, this is no, like, get off the road from Fellowship of the Ring. Unfortunately, yeah. They already activate the tripwire. So the tripwire set off the landmines? Doesn't that feel a bit redundant?
A little bit. But listen, whoever was here, the military people who were here, they were clearly not here for long.
Exactly. So maybe they're like, okay, we don't need both. We'll end up taking down the tripwire, but then they got taken out. But yes. Here come some arrows and some guns at the same
Classic.
Time. Really, cover your bases.
Arrows, guns, and others. Oh my, all of them coming out, including young Eloise Hawking, who at the time we don't necessarily know who this is. We will come to know her, of course.
Right now she's Ellie. I will say here, Josh, maybe this is another one of my hot takes. I'm actually not a huge fan of the actress who plays young Eloise Hawking.
Oh, I like her. I think she's fun.
I just feel like...
What's the issue?
I don't see a lot of connection between, like, the modern-day appearance. Maybe it's because, like, she's supposed to be, like, tough and a little bit smart-alecky, and I don't really see that from this actress's performance. I think she's a little too cutesy.
I disagree. I think, like she keeps having the gun on Faraday, and, like, maybe it's, like, the benefit of knowing what happens in The Variable and the rest of the Hawking arc, but, like, I fully buy this person as somebody who would shoot Faraday. And if anything, like, maybe she doesn't shoot Faraday if Faraday treats her with a little more delicacy in this moment, that his bedside manner now, rather than, like, striving, like, an earnest connection with her moving forward, is going to, like, when she, like, comes out of whatever tent, and here's, like, the situation that's going on with Faraday at the others in the 70s, she's not going to have the wherewithal to, like, be like, oh, that's that weird little quirky time-travel-y science dude. And so she just pops him. So there's an argument, maybe, that Faraday's bedside manner helps get him killed.
Well, I would say, let me clarify here, because there are three Eloise Hawkings. There is Alexandra Krosny, who plays Eloise Hawking in this episode.
Correct.
There's Alice Evans, who plays Eloise Hawking in the 70s episodes that you're mentioning.
Correct.
And then there's, of course, the Fionnuala Flanagan, who plays the older Eloise Hawking. I specifically am not a fan of Alexandra Krosny. I think that maybe it's just because she doesn't have, like, as much building out of the character as Alice Evans does later in the season. I get more Fionnuala Flanagan, FF, I guess. I'll just abbreviate that so I don't stumble over my words anymore. From the middle stage, I guess, of Eloise Hawking that I do the early one. For some reason, I just didn't get a lot from the younger. But we only get one episode of the younger, so who am I to complain?
The weirdest thing, though, is when we get, like, first-person shooter cam. Like, when she goes, who's in charge here? And then, like, we have, like, this first-person shooter mode, which feels oddly like maybe like a season one relic, which would make some sense given that the director of this episode hasn't been here since season one.
You guys still do this, right?
You guys still do like that weird slow-mo thing too, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, sorry, there's no timpanis that are even being used except for one time. What? Yeah. The show's changed, man.
Yeah.
Imagine, you know, this guy walking in and being like, all right, where's Matthew Fox? Where's Evie Lilly?
I'm like, ready to go. Dude, they're not in this one. They're traveling through time.
At least give me my Dominic Monaghan, right? He's got to be here.
Yeah, I went like, where's Matt? Where's Evangel? They're not. They died on the show. No, there's time travel now. What? So like, Jack and Kate and Charlie are trapped. No, Charlie died. Charlie got
just imagine him directing like this scene of Miles and Charlotte and Faraday and being like, look, I don't know who
I don't know who the hell you are.
I don't know who any of you are right now.
Yeah, the director just starts getting the nosebleed, too. He's like, what's going on?
Oh, no, I shouldn't have had chocolate before lunch break.
Oh, my God. I thought I knew the drill here, but I guess I don't. Well, only I know the drill.
Only I know the drill. Hey, listen, at this point, I'm a 20-year-old man. I just got out of college.
I've been on the show since season two. I don't know who you are. You have? No, I'm just messing with you. I'm new here, too. But I'm fitting in pretty well. I'm Saul the drummer.
Pretty good. I know I'm not going to show up for 20 years, but if you look pretty hard, you'll see me.
You'll see me. If you get one of those 70s episodes, you'll see me around.
All right, so they're going to capture Faraday, Miles, and Charlotte. All the Gawkers at this point, we are to assume, are either dead, or if we want a headcanon it, have escaped somehow, Rose and Bernard style.
Yeah, they went to a different section of the creek, hopefully didn't set up any other traps, and maybe they, I don't know, maybe while Richard's doing other stuff, maybe they were able to locate the temple somehow, and Dogen welcomes them in with open arms or something. But yeah, that's, now I think we've officially RIP'd or, you know, written
that's
off
it.
The Gawkers.
That's the Gawkers. They're gone. There's gonna be a Jira Gawkers.
Yeah, certainly.
Not for long. They will also, I think, mostly be killed, which I actually think I almost take more issue with.
Well,
than
right, because
because
this was more of a deliberate plan, right? Of okay, you have to specifically get on this flight that is absolutely needs to crash on the island, and now these poor people were completely unaware that they were part of some sort of master plot.
That's the bigger issue for me is what they do to the Ajira people. It's like the Oceanic people, like. No one on the plane on Oceanic 815, at least that we know of, meant for it to crash.
Right.
In Ajira, you have multiple people on board who are hoping and praying that it does.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's an entire like scheme to get specifically on this plane. So, I mean, it would suck if you're trying to just fly to a certain location. You're trying to fly to Guam for a vacation and you're part of a larger agenda you don't even realize. Maybe that could be like if we ever set up other characters in the Lost RPG, that can be the spiritual sequel. Are the poor people that were on the Ajira flight that just wanted to go to Guam alongside Frank Lapidus and now they're on the island.
All right, so back in the present, on the boat, yes, Penny's boat, Charlie's finished breakfast, Penny goes, yeah, he's a good kid, he listens to me unlike his father, and Desmond's like, come on, I gotta do this thing, I just gotta go do this one thing. She's like, what are you talking, like, how does this work? You don't know how any of this works, and he goes, I know, but I know it happened. Daniel Faraday knocked on the hatch door. He told me to go to Oxford. I'm the only person who could save everybody. I know it sounds insane, but I'm going to do this. I'll be back by dark, and then I'm done with this for good. And so she says, all right, just promise me you're never going back to that island. And he goes, why in God's name would I ever want to go back there? He's like, I won't. How about this? I promise I won't go back to the island this season.
Yeah, exactly. I no guarantees about next season, but this season, definitely not.
I can keep that promise.
Yeah, and
I'm good.
We're going to get this season in multiple instances, right? Like, I believe Desmond's final scene in season 5 is going to be him once again promising Penny after he's healed from his gunshot wound that he's not going to do this. I'm going to say, as much as I love Desmond, I absolutely support Penny in this episode, being like,
oh, she's great.
What the hell are you doing? I am the one who ran away from my father, and I am the person saying, let's not go see my father. He's absolutely going to catch you. He's got goons everywhere. I should know firsthand.
But, like, does he? Because, like, Widmer does a pretty bad job with the goons here,
Well, you know what it is? I think Desmond just does such a great job camouflaging himself and under those sunglasses and that scarf.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, later on in the season, like, Widmore will know where Desmond was shot. He's, like, at the hospital for the variable, I believe. But he just walks out of the office. I hope that he has people following Desmond immediately from that point forward.
I would imagine so. Yeah, I would think so. Boats to tail, maybe, like, scuba divers just sort of, like, hanging out behind the boat, having it drag them along.
Correct. All right, back on the island, young Ellie, she's interrogating everybody. She says, we didn't put the landmines there, you did. So there's already like a little bit of a you're the others type of thing, a mistaken identity case. They think that Faraday and Miles are part of the military that have recently arrived on the island and have entered into conflict with the others. But there's another group of people elsewhere on the island who have a reversed dynamic where our heroes have the others in their sights. And there's a fun reveal in this moment where we find out that they are the others. I like the scene. Let's listen in sound two.
Who are these people?
Well, gee, I didn't have time to ask that with Frogert on fire and all.
They attacked us on the beach.
This is a 30 caliber M1 Garand rifle. Looks new.
Who cares about the rifle? Where the hell you been?
If you've been going through what I have, James, maybe the more appropriate question would be, when the hell have I been?
What happened to your leg?
I got shot.
By who?
We can swap stories later. We told the rest of our group that we would meet them at the creek. If there's any chance of reconnecting with them, we better get moving.
Fine. Seeing as we have no rope to make sure these two don't try to kill us again, I guess we're going to have to shoot them.
Crying on some question to say is...
Take!
What?
Cognos quitus qui sumus.
What language is that?
Speaking Latin. That one asked why we aren't in uniform, and this one told him to shut up.
And how is it that they know how to speak Latin, Julia?
The same reason I do. Because they're others.
It is sort of weird for Juliet to call herself and these people others, right?
Well, I think she's doing it in, like, the language of Sawyer and Locke.
She's translating for them, yeah.
Yeah, I used to have a hang-up on that, too. Where it's like, has she just, like, quickly been like, they are the others? Like, she's othering herself? I think that she's, like, just, like, speaking their language at this point. Like, I don't know that, like, much like the man in black, apparently, like, these guys don't have a name.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. I really like the duality here where we just saw that the hero, our 815 or whatever, our main characters are being captured by the others. And now in this scene, we have the reverse where the others have been captured by our people. And so I really like sort of the cross comparison between that and how these two groups will merge. And yeah, this is where Juliet reveals that, I guess, I mean, does this goes beyond Ben, I suppose, considering it predates him. Is this a Jacob thing that you have to learn Latin if you want to become an other?
Yeah, I think perhaps. I think, like, it's part of, like, the training.
Get with the trends, man. Like, yeah, you know, became Jacob in a time where there were still rustic, almost like caveman-esque villages going on. But we don't speak Latin anymore. Get with the Gen Z lingo.
Yeah, but that being said, like, good secret language, huh?
You know? I suppose so. I don't know.
They don't have to develop it. They just have to trust that not a ton of people know what the hell they're talking about.
Exactly. It's not like ubby-dubby where they have to say, oh, yeah, like, do you speak Otherese? And it's just a completely different language. It's more so, hey, let's take this quote-unquote dead language.
I'm surprised that Sawyer at no point goes like, that's not Latin. I speak Latin. Ixnay on the I'm travel tag.
Yeah, like maybe because if they had a couple of extra lines, they would have done some pig Latin or some boar Latin,
yeah,
as it were.
Boar Latin. Yeah, Locke's like, I speak boar Latin.
I will say that this scene, and you mentioned
also, I feel like season one John Locke would have known instantly that that was Latin.
Yeah, though I think he does a little bit of, like, season one-esque tracking in this episode. There's a bit of a callback. Again, maybe that's the director being like, all right, John Locke, you're one of only two characters I know. You're still tracking, right?
You're still tracking people, right? He's like, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, of course.
I haven't done it in a while. Okay, great. Oh, my God, you're my constant. You're my constant John Locke hunting. I will say that one thing that this scene does, and they do a couple times in this episode, that I'm not the biggest fan of, is, again, another one of your hang-ups from season four, right? The whole, like, okay, we're going to ask this question, but then someone gets interrupted before they can answer the question. It's a small thing here, because I don't think Locke revealing that he got shot by Ethan is, like, a huge revelation, but I just find it an interesting choice that it's like Sawyer asked Locke, but Locke can't respond because Juliet interrupts him.
Correct. So I like this. I think that this is a cool dynamic. And of course, little baby Whitmore here.
Such an a-hole.
Yeah, he's great.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba.
The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Back on the Faraday team, Miles has like a little moment. He walks over a fresh grave. He says that there are four soldiers who have died, one of whom died from radiation poisoning, but none of them mentioned what year it is. Here's what I love about this scene. Faraday doesn't really question this at all.
Yep.
And what I love about Faraday and Miles, which is a dynamic we don't get really nearly a lot of, is that these are basically two like powered up people. Miles has like the literal, like, I can speak to dead people power, or like he can like, yeah, he could speak to like BODYS power. I guess like he doesn't need the body. You know, he was able to do the ghost busting thing back in Confirmed Dead. But he could speak to the dead, and Faraday like understands time travel. He's like, kind of like harnessed the ideas of time travel. There's like this mutual respect of each other's skill sets here that I love, where it's just like kind of unquestioning. Like, there are some ways in which that core four freighter team are like tighter and in more lockstep than 815 has ever been.
Right, because I think that they sort of understand each other's skill set, and maybe that's in part due to the fact that they were assembled as a team for that very reason, as opposed to this group of people slammed together in a plane crash who had to figure out what each other was good at. This was, okay, you're the one who talks to dead people. You're the one who knows time travel. Charlotte, you're there.
Were cool last season. You knew every language. You would have known Latin.
She would have known Latin, exactly, or even Boer Latin. But I think that having that specialization helps. I mean, this is a great episode for Faraday, not even just because of the time travel stuff, but like also his investigatorial abilities. Daniel Faraday is sort of like a Sherlock to me in this episode, where he's picking up these like imperceptible details, right? He sees that someone's hands are wrapped up, and then off of the radiation burns remark from Miles, puts two and two together, and then says, okay, conclusion, they were setting off bombs here, and so because they did that in this time of, in this era, even though I don't know what era it is, and he ends up making some very correct educational guesses. So again, like, this is Daniel Faraday's sandbox at the moment, and he is loving every second of it.
He's loving every minute. He's loving it. They get brought to the camp, the military camp. Although this is like sort of like early others, but are they like using military gear at this point?
Yeah. So we know that like Widmore and Cunningham, like, they took the uniforms of the soldiers. I'm still not sure why. Maybe it was for them to like, I don't know, infiltrate the military disguised as soldiers, or maybe they were just doing it for the lulls. But it does seem like, you know, because the village is not going to get built, right? That's what middle stage Eloise Hawking's going to say later in the season, was that they buried the bomb and then they built a village on top of it. So I don't think it's established at this point, but I would imagine if they're not actually in the military encampments, they're at least using their tents. But Josh, this is a location that actually I don't think we've discussed too much as like a central location on Lost, the Mesa.
Yeah.
Not to reference Westworld.
Westworld, yeah.
But the Mesa is, I mean, it showed up in the very first episode, right? Like, this is where Team Transponder goes to try to get the radio signal. But we know that it's also where the Dharma van gets started up. It's where the golf course is. And this is where they find a flat piece of land to sort of serve as their encampment. So we are at the Mesa once more. It's also going to serve as a spot for another sort of like Dharma-esque moment. This is where Ben's going to drive his dad out into the middle of nowhere and kill him.
So I believe we'll be here in the end when Jack and Notlock's crews kind of collide before they go off towards the bamboo forest together.
Yeah, so like it's a very meaningful place, even more so than the one creek. And so I love that we sort of keep coming back to this place as a touchstone. And here, when you talk about, you talked about how in the end that the Mesa is sort of a source of a lot of volatility. Really fun stuff has happened. Really dark stuff has happened, including, in this case, this is where a near-active bomb is sort of situated at the moment.
Correct, yes. So a lot going on. Richard Alpert's here. It's kind of a really big moment. Yeah, we've already seen Alpert through time, but like just like because like so much has been so unstable on the island that mm-hmm. to get this force of stability that like you know, sort of like same Alpert, different time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's just it's a really cool layer of Constance. Who's Constance?
I also love.
I think that's great.
I also love the exchange of "What's your name? What's your name?" Faraday. Either Faraday does a really good job, or the others do a really bad job of just completely giving away the game. Because then you have them reply like, oh, you must have come back for your bomb. And it's like, wow, they're giving away a lot of information. If they happen to not be military, which they're not, you certainly are sort of just explicitly saying off the top who they are, why they're here, and the fact that there is like a weapon that is on the island that they could very easily detonate if they want to.
Yeah, for sure. I assume you've come back for your bomb. Meanwhile, Desmond goes to Oxford, and Mike, say what you will about Desmond David Hume, but this dude looks like Bono. Like this dude looks like a rock star. He's got the shades. He's got the scarf. The beard is shaved, but it's still got a little bit of that stubble. The hair is out. Like the Bono comparisons for some people are going to be insulting, but I mean it as in like its most highest complimentary sense that Desmond Hume looks like a rock star right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is among my favorite Desmond looks is how he looks in this episode.
I mean, he is certainly island hot, but I agree. He cleans up well.
He just cleans up so great. It's like he shared so much headspace with Charlie Pace, it's like he absorbed all of his rock star powers.
Well, not to mention, I think it's very convenient that Desmond looks like Bono in an episode where we learn how to dismantle an atomic bomb.
That's correct. Yeah. Wow. Good connect. No one at Oxford wants to tell Desmond shit about Daniel Faraday. It seems like he's been scrubbed from the system. But Desmond has memories from the Constance. So he kind of like knows his way around this place. He's been here before.
Yeah, sort of, though, because Desmond has a moment, right, when she asks, oh, when were you here last? And Desmond can't remember. Do we think that's just like a blip in his memory? Do you think it's like the more time he spends away from the island, the more the timey-wimey-ness affects him? What did you think about this like momentary lapse in memory?
I kind of take it as like Desmond has probably like these blackout periods in his life. Like, you know, I still subscribe to the idea that the flashes before your eyes stuff is canon.
Right, it happened.
And that's sort of my thinking on it. And so like he has that he has that blacked out for himself. Like, he doesn't really remember that. And, like, probably a lot of the reasons why he feels like such a coward is he just, like, he forgot so much stuff. And, like, he doesn't even know why he, like, ruined shit with Penny. He doesn't remember going to her on Christmas. He doesn't remember, like, you know, going AWOL. Like, that's how I tend to read Desmond. Maybe there's like some level of like projection on my part of like wanting there to be like the character who like has these like sort of like traumatic memory gaps that make it hard for him to like fully like, did I do that? Did that happen? Like,
mm-hmm.
I suffer from an extent of that. I'm not going to get too heavy with it, but like I have like, you know, I often talk about like my bad brain. Oh my God, I don't remember stuff. But like I genuinely just like lose information quickly. And it's been happening to me for like, you know, decade plus at this point, and it sucks. I really hate it. And like I feel that through the Desmond storyline. I think that there's enough in the text that can play into that idea. So like I think like he knows it happened, but maybe he doesn't know that like it was 1990 whatever. Maybe he doesn't remember that. You know, there's like bits of it that maybe he just doesn't quite get.
I think it's also very likely, and maybe it's because I've been binging so much X-Files, that maybe there's something that's repressed as well. I know I actually watched an episode of the X-Files this week where Fox Mulder is investigating sort of like his repressed memories, and there's a lot of like sense stuff that comes about. And so maybe that's a thing with Desmond where like he knows, but he sort of doesn't know how to get into Faraday's office. You know what you need, Josh? You need a Cockney janitor come in and be like, "All right, this is what you missed. This is everything that happened. Don't you worry. I caught you up.
I got you, puppet." Yeah, here comes the janitor in the physics department who is like, "I wondered when someone would figure out we weren't just fumigating."
Yeah. He's a hardened guy, but I would understand. He's like, he sort of is in the Mike Rowe-esque position of like having to burn all of the dead rats that Daniel Faraday was experimenting on. Like, yeah, I'd be pretty ticked at the guy as well.
Tough gig. The fumigator, the fumigatekeeper. he talked about how Faraday was sending rats' brains back in time. He was doing all sorts of weird science. And Desmond asks why there was no record of him. And the fumigator says, "Can you blame anybody after what he did to that poor girl?" And so both Desmond and us now at this point are like, "That poor who?"
What? So, I mean, and we did see, we saw, you know, a picture on the ground right before this of Daniel posing with a woman that looks like a young Leslie Mann. It turns out it will be Teresa Spencer, which we'll get into more with the variable, I believe. But yeah, this is the beginning of, hey, you know how Daniel Faraday is kind of like that fun, quirky, mulleted guy that we met back in Oxford? He did some pretty sick shit there as well.
Yeah. Well, you know what? He is the son of the woman who will murder him. So it's a pretty tough upbringing.
Yeah, and also the son of this like egomaniacal maniac as well.
There's a lot going on, and he didn't really have anyone raising him with any semblance of like nurture and care. So he really is getting it on both sides, which totally sucks for poor Daniel Faraday, but does not excuse what happens to Teresa.
She fell down the stairs. She fell up the stairs. She went back in time. She went into a coma.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are theories out there, by the way, that the Teresa of the Daniel Faraday story is the Teresa of the Boone Carlyle story, but also having heard that, like, Kitsis and Horowitz were so obsessed with the name Lapidus that they just, like, refused to, like, do Lost without naming someone Lapidus. Just gotta imagine someone in the writer's room liked the name Teresa.
I mean, listen, we just talked about a young character named after two guys who have the same name, Charles. I think that recurring names is just something that they like to do on Lost.
Yeah, I think that's fine. All right. So, meanwhile, with the Faraday team, Daniel's trying to calm everyone down. They think we're the military. They think we're Michael. We just got to stay still and pretend like we're plants. No, he says they think that we're army. We should stay alive. That's going to be, you know, we'll stay alive if we let them think that we're part of the army. Albert comes in and is like, "So what the hell? You guys attack us? You come to the island? What do you think? We're not going to defend ourselves?" And Faraday at this point is like, "Hey, so my friend who sees dead people talked to some ghosts and told me that they died from radiation. I assume that there's a hydrogen bomb here."
Yeah.
And so it's a pretty good guess. Smart work on Daniel Faraday's part. He says, "This is an unstable device. It's capable of destroying this whole island. Let me render it inert." And Albert says, "Well, how do I know that you're not on some sort of suicide mission?" And Faraday proves that his intentions are genuine by confessing his love for Charlotte.
It's a, you know, brave tactic, Cotton. Let's see if it ends up working out for him. I mean, it does, but it's an odd sort of go for broke thing, right? Like, how do you know you, like, how won't you go on the suicide mission? "Well, because I love the person sitting next to me." Great. Maybe she's on a suicide mission and wants to blow up the island. You know, just because you're on it with someone that you love, if anything, you might Bonnie and Clyde style want to go out in a blaze of glory together, having blown up the island. It's an odd defense and piece of evidence, but it somehow holds water in this kangaroo court that's going on.
It's weird. I don't know. Like, I'm in love with the woman next to me and I never do anything to hurt her. It's kind of odd, and for Albert, that's good enough.
Here's the thing, though. Do you think Faraday should use the argument he uses with Ellie with Richard Albert? Considering that, I don't know if he knows at this moment, but we know that Richard Albert is someone who, like, is capable of not necessarily traveling through time, but has seen so much time that I think if you are presenting the argument of like, I'm from the future and I know what happens 50 years from now to anyone about the island, I think Richard Alpert would probably be the most understanding in that capacity.
Well, that being said, Alpert's going to be really incredulous when John Locke comes to him. Eventually, like, you know, he plays ball and he certainly believes enough because the guy disappears in front of him. That he needs to go check out, you know, Tunstin, California in 1956. Maybe, but I also don't think Faraday knows who Richard Alpert is. You know,
yeah,
Alpert is largely absent from season four and not really on Faraday's radar.
Yeah, because I do wonder, you know, obviously Charles Widmore sent them an entire dossier about 815 that Miles memorized by heart. I guess the question is, are some of the other residents on the dossier, right? Like, we know Ben Linus is because that's their mission, but did Charles Widmore tip them off about, like, well, watch out for a guy named Richard Alpert. He might be helping Ben. He looks like he's wearing eyeliner, but don't let that fool you. He's very, very much alive, and he has been for many years.
Yeah. So he's gonna let him go. He's gonna let him go take care of the bomb. Meanwhile, let's go to Team Locke, Sawyer, and Juliet. Fun little scene here in the woods. We'll listen in sound three.
Who taught you Latin?
Oh, that was 101. Gotta learn Latin. Language of the enlightened.
Lighten my ass.
I suggest you talk to us. Once we get back to the creek and meet up with the rest of our people, there's going to be a lot of anger directed at you for attacking them.
The rest of your people are either captured or dead.
What? What makes you say that?
That idiot shouted out, meet at the creek. I knew exactly where they were headed. I sent a group after them.
Well, maybe I should have said it in my secret language.
James, wait. Nos non somos hostes vobes.
Intaque nos liberate.
What the hell are you saying?
Duque nos ad vestra castra. Si placet.
Quare hoc faciam.
His name, Ricardus, maybe? Ricardus Alpert?
Did you just say Richard Alpert?
John, please. Duque nos ad vestra castra. Non necesse est alium mori. Si placet.
Okay, we need to head east. Another couple kilometers till we hit the ridge.
Shoot him! Shoot, damn it! Are you crazy? What were you thinking? Why didn't you shoot him?
Because he's one of my people.
So here's a fun what if. What if he did shoot Charles Widmore? Would it be like the prologue to the baby Ben Linus stuff where he doesn't die, but like they have to bring him to the temple and that's how he gets invigorated with this evil spirit?
I guess. I mean, like the one thing that would have, like, he shoots Charles Widmore. Charles Widmore can't die.
Exactly.
That's
because,
not
because
on the table.
Whatever happened, happened. And so therefore, like, he can't be expunged from the timeline after that.
Yeah. But I think what he does do is he kind of just like wrecks him in terms of reputationally hip checks Widmore when he shows up later, like, nice to meet you, when he shows up at the camp. Yeah, here's more than that, that I would like to discuss is Locke lets him go because he's one of my people. But didn't John Locke just murder one of his people?
Yeah, that's odd. Maybe it's because now that he realized they're one of his people, he could let him go. Like, at least he can blame that on ignorance, right? Like, oh, you were about to chop off the hands of one of my friends, so I had to stop you. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I'm your leader? Ooh, okay, sorry about that firing, but I'm still a good boss, so I'm going to let you take a little vacay and leave the office a bit early.
Yeah. So I don't love that piece of it. Breaking the scene down, because there's a lot that, you know, just went down here, including breaking the neck of poor Richard Cunningham and his wife.
Yeah, going the way of Richie Cunningham's brother from Happy Days, right? Like going up the stairs and never came back down.
So Cunningham is going to get killed, Teresa style, and that's fun. Widmore running off. The thing that I like the most here is this moment at the top between Juliet and Sawyer. Who taught you Latin? And she goes, "Others 101." It's starting to get a little cute here. These kids are starting to get a little cute,
Mike. But it's also, not only is there some cuteness, though, there's, again, some fun foreshadowing here, right, where she says, Latin 101, language of the enlightened, and Sawyer says, enlighten my ass. Sawyer has such obvious derision for the others, not knowing he's going to become, you know, among them, essentially, as a member of the Dharma Initiative in the 70s. So that's a little fun thing as well, that's a reminder of, like, Sawyer's pure hatred of the people that he's going to end up working alongside in the near future.
Yeah. So I think that that's cute. I like it. I like where they're starting to take us here with soy sauce and Juliet.
This is a good Juliet episode in general. She calls them out on the Latin stuff. She is the translator right here. As cute as Sawyer is, he gets a little bit of Eggtown on his face when Cunningham says, like,
he's
well, you did yell meet at the creek, so you kind of was able to corral all the herd the sheep into, like, one central place to slaughter everybody. So, yoke's on you, funny boy. But, you know, that's one of the last things that Cunningham says here. And even though Locke let Widmore go, Widmore's going to leave a pretty easy trail in his wake for the trio to follow.
Yes, yes, he is. Absolutely. All right. So in the present, back in Great Britain, the island, Desmond is going to meet Abigail, Teresa's sister. He says, I'm here about Daniel Faraday. Oh, Daniel Faraday! Well, why didn't you say so? You must come in.
It's so odd.
Back in the day, Mike not liking this character a lot. On this watch, I kind of liked her being like, Daniel Frickin' Faraday. Well, sure, come on in. Why not?
It's like a sarcastic version of the guard from Wizard of Oz. Of like, well, it's a horse of a different color. Come on in, Desmond.
Come on in. Why not? Teresa, she's Billy Pilgriming. She's unstuck in time, and it sounds like she's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, she's not full Minkowski at this rate, right? Like, doesn't seem like she's in poor health necessarily, in that, like, her body is giving out on her. It's more so like her mind is just perennially moving through time that has rendered her comatose.
Well, she wakes up every now and then and, like, talks about all of, like, the disjointed things she's seeing through time. Does seem like she's only alive because of Mr. Charles Widmore's interference or assistance, if you want to look at it that way. But, like, is she just, like, sort of, like, experiencing her entire life? I guess depending on the life she lived, you know, maybe she's happy, maybe she's not. Maybe she's going to the future, too. Mm. Like, who knows? Like, maybe someday, in the same way that that Claire's mother was able to heal, Teresa will heal after Faraday's death, perhaps. Yeah. You know, like, maybe that will release her. So I'd like to think that there is brightness ahead for Teresa.
We
have no idea, because otherwise it is such a grim, grim story.
Well, because then it essentially renders that, like, Daniel Faraday and anyone within his proximity just suffers the darkest fate in life, right? We talked about that with the way that Daniel Faraday is going to die, but also the person that was his girlfriend, like, the closest thing he had to a love until Charlotte, who he experimented on, is now in this torturous situation. I'd like to hope there's some mercy, that there's some light at the end of the tunnel there.
Yes. She was this is all because of Faraday's experiments. She's away right now.
Yeah, and also not only due to the experiments, but apparently Daniel Faraday also abandoned her when he found out that, you know, essentially what happened to her. And there was only one person that stepped in and helped her in her time of need, Mr. Charles Widmore.
Of course. There is the charitable read is that Faraday and Teresa were in this together, and then the experiments went wrong and Faraday got messed up in his own right, because, you know, we do see him with the whole, like, I don't know why the island is upsetting me stuff. Like, he definitely seems a little wobbly in his own way. So did he abandon her? Was he taken away potentially by Widmore and like institutionalized in a way that Widmore has tabs on him because he is going to be able to visit him to recruit him for the island? Is he trying to make his life as comfortable as possible in the lead up to his ultimate death? I think like he abandoned her could be a little bit off the mark. There is a large degree to which Daniel Faraday's entire life is not his fault.
Mm-hmm.
That of any character on the show, or of many of the characters on the show, certainly John Locke is going to be on that list, as we'll be able to discuss in a few scenes from now. But Faraday is on the record, right? Like, he is, you can't spin a record. Like, he has been, the needle has been put on, and it won't stop until he's shot. Like, he doesn't have a choice in his fate. It's really, really circularly locked.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that Daniel Faraday, at least even in this episode, has shown himself to be a bit of a lover, right? Like, he was one of the softer spots of the freighter group in season 4. So I wouldn't necessarily take him as the type of person to outright just flee at the first sign of danger for someone that he really cares about. But Daniel Faraday also could have been a very different person before his experiments, right? So maybe that is in line with like a pre-experiment Daniel Faraday. One way or the other, but either way, whatever happened, and whether he meant to or not, Daniel Faraday has left this island. He will go to another one eventually and has essentially abandoned Teresa and her very odd talking sister.
Yeah, so back on the island in the 1950s, Faraday's going to talk about how hydrogen bombs were being tested in the Pacific in the 50s. That's how he was able to make this this prediction. Charlotte tells Daniel, you didn't have to say that. There were so many other ways you could have convinced him.
And that's the other thing as well, is that this sort of feels like a mimeograph of the Kate and Sawyer stuff from season 3, right? They're like, oh, you didn't have to tell Pickett that you loved me when you clearly didn't mean it. Oh, but do I? It just feels like, again, a repeat of that similar type of trope with two characters that we care much less about.
Correct. He says, I said it because I meant it, Charlotte. I said it because the writers made me do it. No, I said it because I meant it.
That's the other thing. Daniel Faraday's at the mercy of so many people. His mother, his father, the writers of Lost.
Yeah. So young Eloise is going to come and start walking Faraday away. Albert's going to tell Daniel, like, we've already, you know, like, we've had a big offensive with these soldiers. We've, you know, killed a bunch of these people already. There's this whole line about, like, you answer to a chain of command, right? Well, so do I. So Richard is saying that they killed the soldiers because he was told to.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't sound to me like Jacob.
You don't think so?
Does Jacob, like, tell Richard really what to do? Or does Jacob mostly... What is Jacob's ethos? I know, like, Riley frothing at the mouth right now.
Our mutual friend, Riley, yes, not to quote the boat.
Love you, Riley. Like, I know, like the Jacob haters out there, but, like, also, like, isn't Jacob's whole thing, like, they're going to do what they want to do.
Yeah, but...
When you get to do the thing, and that's just going to happen the way it's supposed to happen, man.
But
you know, like, he's sort of like pre-Dharma.
But at the same time, when it's as extreme as, like, they're going to blow up a bomb on the island, maybe then you sort of become a bit more of the bad cop. When it's that extreme of a scenario, maybe when they were squatting on the land, Jacob was more fine with it, but it's like, oh, you're detonating weapons on the island? This island that is so special and like where I essentially live and my spirit will exist evermore? That's no good.
Yeah, could be. I mean, I think it's possible in that regard too, that like they have failed the test.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like they have chosen war, but I don't know. A little hard for me to justify. I'm just also trying to think what would be. Is there any Man in Black kind of way that this would work? that Smokey's not able to take on Jacob's likeness.
Yeah, like,
so
would he appear as, like, a dead person that Richard knows to say, oh, you know, you won't believe this, Richard. It's me, Phil, the other that just got killed. I was just talking with Jacob, and he said we should kill all the soldiers. So I think we should do that, because Jacob told us.
Yeah, I don't know. So it's a little bit like I'm not entirely sure here, unless Jacob's just like, yeah, kill him, whatever, it's fine. You know, a little bit of the inconsistencies there for me, or at least it's a little harder for me to glom onto. Widmore shows up. He's going to warn Alpert that there's another group here. They're being led by a sodding old man. You think he can track me? You think he knows this place better than me? Cut to John Locke in the woods just watching this happen from a distance.
Well, and it's also a great setup as well that, again, it's not going to be John Locke, but I feel like season six is a lot about Widmore finally finding the island versus sort of like the man in black. And so I think it is maybe unintentionally, because I don't know if they have that in mind for Endgame at the moment, but setting up sort of the dual antagonists in season six, even though they're not working together, but it is very much going to be these two figures will cross paths in the future.
Correct. So Locke is going to be talking to Juliet. How did you know Alpert would be here? He's always been here. He's like the groundskeeper at the Overlook Hotel. He's always been here. How old is he? Says John. How old is he?
Old. Nothing. Old. Nothing creative. No. Yeah. I would not be good with Juliet on Match Game. I don't think she'd be very, very, you know, jokey in that regard.
Old. So John wants to go and have a chat with Ricardus. He wants to pick up where we left off. He's like, I'm going to go down. I'm going to finish my conversation with Richard. Sawyer says, Locke, you're going to get us killed. Locke says, listen, you want to go and march off after Faraday? That's great. I'll give you a 10-minute head start.
Yeah, it's this weird dynamic where John Locke is going to be the one to, you know, reset the wheel and help save all these people. But at the moment, this is more so like Locke saying, hey, I'm going your guy's way. Mind if I hitch a ride? Like, he still has his own mission. As we talked about at this point, he still believes he's the leader of the others, and he has completely almost like extricated himself from 815 in that regard. It's only in the next few episodes when he is just like alongside these people that he's going to get integrated back into the group. As this scene displays once more and helps remind Sawyer and Juliet, Locke's going to go off and do his own thing. Much as you think he might have helped you because he killed one of the soldiers, he always has an agenda that he's pursuing.
Always does. All right. So he's going to say to Julia, are you team Crazy Town or Crazy Town over Egg Town, I would say. Faraday is going to be walking with Eloise. We listened to this at the top of the episode. He says, I can't shake this feeling that I recognize you. I also can't shake this feeling that you're going to shoot me in 1977.
Yeah, but in this moment, I mean, obviously Faraday doesn't know that. He's sort of calling Ellie's bluff, right? He's going to get into it later, but he's like, he actually advances on her. He like puffs his chest being like, go ahead, shoot me. Like I'm too helpful to you right now. Also, I'll point out later that we are in the vicinity of an active bomb. So of course you wouldn't do that. So like, I'm going to call your bluff, not realizing decades from now, she is indeed going to shoot him.
Yes, indeed. All right. So he's going to see the bomb. She's going to tell him to disarm it. And Mike, we are actually in this moment where we basically have the rest of the episode in sound.
Good, people can get a rest from our voices.
This is what I'll say about Jughead, Mike, is that like I think from this moment forward, I think it's just like filled with dynamite scenes. Like I think all of the scenes
nice
from
choice
this
of words.
Point out. Yeah, I think like from this point out, it's just like it's a really electro episode. So I'm excited to listen in. Let's start with sound. For Faraday is going to examine the Jughead. He's going to see that it is weeping. He is not happy about that. And he is going to make his displeasure very, very, very clear.
Back up.
What?
Get back. It's unsafe. We need to move.
I swear, if you try anything...
If I try anything, what? You're gonna shoot me. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be perfect because, of course, rifle fire right next to, what would you call this? Hydrogen bomb. Yes, fantastic idea, really inspired. Okay, listen to me. Do you people have any access to lead or concrete?
For what?
There's a crack in the casing. It needs to be filled with lead. You need to take it off this platform carefully and bury it.
You brought me all the way out here to tell us that we have to bury it? I told Albert you could disarm that thing.
You don't need to worry. You do what I say, you bury it, it won't go off.
How'd you know that?
I need you to trust me.
I don't trust you.
Just bury it. Bury it, and everything will be fine. Remember, you're superior.
How can you be so sure?
You want to take care of this bomb? You bury it.
How'd you know that?
Because 50 years from now, this island is still here. There you...
What did you just say?
Whoa. Take it easy. I can explain myself a little better. I know how this sounds. Believe me, it's hard to explain. 50 years from now, me and my friends, that's where we're from, okay? And here's the key. Everything's fine. I'm not saying it's perfectly fine, but there hasn't been any atomic blast, all right?
Yeah. Drop your gun, Blondie.
It's okay. She's okay. You can put your gun down.
She puts hers down first.
Why don't we all put our guns down?
I said drop it!
Son of a bitch.
Are they from the future too?
You told her?
Another reason why this isn't a great episode for Sawyer, Josh, he repeats then the same nickname that he gives to the very person that's next to him. Don't say Blondie when the other Blondie's right there.
Is Juliet Blondie yet, or is this like going to become like an inside joke where like, remember that time traveling lady we called Blondie?
You're her now. I feel like he might have used it at some point in season 3 or 4.
Yeah. I like the scene a lot. Like, there's like the intensity of it that like feels even more intense when you know that she is like very capable of just shooting Daniel point blank.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, again, this is an image that we are going to be introduced to later in the season that is going to end in a very, very different way. We also know that Daniel Faraday is going to serve as like Eloise Hawking's maybe jumping off point for exploring the idea of time travel as well, which we've already seen in Lost that she sort of is the representative of. You can imagine this was really an eye-opening moment for her, much like John Locke was for Richard Alpert later on, of it being like, wait a minute, time travel is capable on this island. Okay, there's a lot more to this than I may think. It's a seminal moment for this character. And again, we don't know it yet because we don't know who Ellie is. But when you know the full scope of things, it's a really important moment.
Hugely so. So I really like it on that level. I love Sawyer just like being totally on board. Like, he has no choice. Like, he's living it now. Like, you told her that we're traveling through time.
Yeah.
It's like kind of like really incredible.
And I do feel bad for Sawyer because Sawyer, again, he's trying to be this leader, right? He's trying to bust in and save Faraday. But Faraday kind of had this handled. Like, I don't think Ellie would have shot him necessarily. He provides a laundry list of reasons why she wouldn't. But I'm glad he came in with sort of like the extra ammo. But good on Faraday, able to sort of like talk his way out of a situation. He is really doing super well on his like investigation and deception roles in the course of this episode.
And I also appreciate Juliet coming in and being like, how about we drop our guns? How about, like, nobody shoot each other? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, and I mean, listen, Sawyer doesn't go through with it. He, you know, listens to one Blondie instead of the other, but that continues to be Juliet the Great Diplomat. She did this at the end of Because You Left, remember, of like, we've all had a tough day, let's just go back. She's a great mediator, Juliet Burke.
So we're at this point, right, where Faraday is, like, emphatic about how to get rid of the bomb. And this is going to provide, you know, this is what he's going to get them to do is ultimately what's going to cause so much of Lost to happen. But by like causing so much of Lost to happen, Faraday is also beginning, you know, he's essentially shooting himself. he is launching into action a plan that he will like get like this harebrained idea on of like, what if we're not just on rails? What if we do have choice, only to come to realize that, no, he was right the whole time and he's going to get himself shot by this very same woman. So it's interesting stuff. I know when it, as it pertains to the bomb itself, we've got some feedback. We'll put a pin in that for now. Pour some lead on that.
Don't pull out the pin.
Don't pull out the pin. Let's go from one of Faraday's parents to another. Let's jump back to the present as Desmond David Hume is going to come in steaming hot, barking mad to Charles Widmore, now knowing that he's connected to Daniel Faraday. Sound number five.
Mr. Widmore, I'm so sorry. He charged right past me.
That's all right, Melanie. Mr. Hume is a colleague of mine. Please leave us.
I know you have questions for me. I'm not going to answer them. I've come here to ask you something. And once you've told me everything I need to know, you'll never see me again. Understand?
All right.
I need to know where I can find Daniel Faraday's mother.
What makes you think I would even know the answer to that?
Because even before you put Faraday on your little boat and sent him off to the island, you spent 10 years funding his research. So I figure you must know something regarding his next of kin.
Desmond, I haven't seen or heard from my daughter for 3 years. Just answer me this. Is she safe?
Where's Faraday's mother?
She's in Los Angeles. This is an address for her. I suspect she won't be pleased to see you. She's a very private person. Wait, Desmond. Deliver your message, and then get out of this mess. Don't put Penny's life in danger.
Danger?
You're getting yourself involved in something that goes back many, many years. It has nothing to do with you or my daughter. Wherever you were hiding, go back there.
Thanks for the advice.
I always loved how Desmond bursts into Winmore's office like Aragorn does into Rohan, right? Yeah. Where he's just like, through the double doors.
Yeah, the Dumbledores. Yeah, he goes right in, charging like a bull. And I also love that he sticks to the plan. He's like, I know you have questions. I'm not going to answer them because you suck and I'm awesome. And you peed on my hands, as Mike always likes to remind us. Yeah, I like this scene a lot because it's just great to see the power shift.
Mm-hmm.
Desmond knows the stuff. There's one thing he wants to know. And just the promise of leverage with maybe telling Charles about what's going on with Penny, he feels like is enough to get the answers. But he just like walks in there with all the confidence of a man who's been through everything that he's been through, thanks in no small part to the actions of Charles Widmore, and is able to kind of leverage that into getting exactly what he wants. I think for Widmore's part, to that point that we talked about earlier, he must just like automatically be like, Janice, can you please send Bob and Dan to go and track down Desmond?
Yeah,
and just,
or
like,
just
tail
like
them
who,
they're
do,
going
who do you have in LA? Silas? Yeah, can you go give Silas a ring and tell him to just like
go call Silas,
hang out outside the lamppost, because I feel like Desmond Hume's coming there.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I love this scene. We're a far cry from Widmore denying Desmond McCutcheon. There's sort of like a trilogy of Desmond and Widmore in Widmore's office scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we had that in Flashes Before Your Eyes. Mm-hmm. I guess it isn't in the office, but we have the scene in The Constant at the auction.
No, but we'll have one in the afterlife.
I guess
have
that counts,
one
yeah.
In the final season, and so it's like totally different there. So yeah, that's great. I think this is a good midpoint.
And I like it because Desmond's almost taking a page out of Ben's book here, in that Widmore softens a bit. Granted, I think he's fine giving away the information. Because as we talked about last week, like maybe it's just something that he's not necessarily privy to or something he can't access due to whatever rules might be set up. But I do think that Desmond sort of has a win here in being able to not only get with Penny, but almost like take her away from her father, right? Like it's almost like a Jin Mr. Paik thing where he was able to steal her out from under his clutches. And so now Widmore feels a little defeated in that regard, and this is something that Desmond can hold over Widmore for once in his life. And so I do really like the shift in that power structure, even though it seems like Widmore is maybe volunteering that information for whatever reason. At least it's initially perceived as like, wow, Desmond actually gets a win here over the supreme, all-powerful Charles Widmore, and he's able to like walk out without having to suffer in any sort of ramification. Though maybe this starts to lead to Widmore being like, oh, Desmond's back. All right, well, I have this idea to capture him and put him under a bunch of like electromagnetic experimentation when I make it onto the island.
Well, I think that there might be like, you know, in reconnecting with Eloise, which they'll do around the time that he gets shot. Right. I think like there could be like, you know, reading him in a little bit more on just how special he is. Like at this point also, I think like you have to imagine, no, for sure. At this point, Widmore has picked up John Locke. Right. The mm-hmm. Jeremy Bentham mm-hmm. stuff has happened. So he's already like starting to like make his moves to reorganize. And like you can even tell in terms of like the tenor of his conversation between Desmond and Penny that like the reason he doesn't like do anything towards Desmond right now maybe is like, does he feel like some of this stuff is like the fated stuff to happen in order to make all of these other things happen? Like if he knows that John Locke travels through time, if he knows all of this stuff is inevitably going to go down, does he feel like he needs to let Desmond kind of be off the chain to a certain degree, but also like understands and respects how special he is in a way that he didn't know before? We talked once before about how much does Charles know. Is he like being a jerk to Desmond because he understands his role actually is very important? Or is this sort of like a blind side for Widmore eventually? And I think like the more sensible and I think also more enjoyable one is that like Widmore got Desmond totally wrong. And so like he's just like eating humble pie in smoothie form and mm-hmm. just like chugging it all day long around Desmond, because like the way he's talking to Desmond here is very different than the way he's ever talked to him before. And I would also say that the way we're getting Widmore in this moment is so different from the Widmore that we are going to get in this next scene. Just to keep the Widmore conversation going, let's go back to the 50s, go back to the island as John Locke is going to walk into town, and we get the episode's great Charles Widmore reveal.
Richard Alpert! Hey! Yeah. Hey! I'm looking for Richard.
Don't move.
Richard Alpert! Now! Richard, I need to talk to you! No! That's enough!
Who are you?
My name is John Locke.
Is that supposed to mean something to me?
Jacob sent me.
Put the gun down.
What? Richard, you can't seriously trust him.
I said, put
the gun down, Whitmore.
Your name is Whitmore? Charles Whitmore?
What's it to you?
Nothing. Nice to meet you.
I love that TOQ smile, baby!
Whitmore says what sounds like, "What's C to you?" And the answer to that question shall be revealed in Worst Day Ever, the 24 Season 1 Recap podcast that will be available before the next episode of Down the Hatch. How about that? Yeah, pretty good.
Brilliant, brilliant segue.
It kind of sounds like it. What's CTU?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't think, had CTU been sort of like created yet in
not
the 50s?
Yet, not yet.
Yeah, uh-uh, so maybe so. We're talking about some other time traveling elements. I love the smile on Locke's face when he's like, Oh my God, this is baby Charles Whitmore? Oh, you're such a little shit. Oh, this is hilarious.
He's such a turd. He's like, oh my God, this is the guy I'm scared of. But like after everything he's been through, to see Whitmore here, I think he's cracking up. I do wonder, given more time, if he didn't just blink away, right? Mm-hmm. Does John Locke just like kill this guy?
Yeah, but then again, we ask, like, what would happen then?
Yeah, like, is that what his intentions are, though? He's like, and by the way, that Whitmore guy, you're going to have to let me kill him.
Yeah, but I was told by Jacob, because, you know, Jacob tells you to kill people. He told me specifically that this one little a-hole has to go in your camp. Everyone else can live, but this little guy has got to go.
Because, like, at this point, Mike, like, he hasn't talked to Faraday. He doesn't know whatever happened.
Right.
You know? So maybe for him, he's like, yeah, if I stick around, I'll kill that guy and maybe solve all the problems.
It's going to come into the next scene, right, with their meeting, where, like, Locke essentially is going to, whether he means to or not, manifest that whatever happened, of like, hey, here's this time loop that I'm going to essentially begin. Here's a compass.
Yes. John Locke is going to make his own destiny.
He's going to make his own lock.
Yes, he's going to make his own lock is what's going to happen next. So I just love that scene. Shitty little Whitmore. All right, let's go back to the present. Let's stop in with Desmond one last time with Penny. He comes bearing knowledge, folks. Let's listen in. Sound number 7.
And the fishy suddenly peeked out, but it saw the bear so that it ran away again. Where?
Hi.
Hi.
Good day.
Yeah. He wanted to go fishing in the Thames. We were unsuccessful. And you? Did you find Faraday's mum?
There's no one to find. She died a few years ago.
Why are you lying to me?
What? I'm not.
Where is she?
She's in Los Angeles. Look, Penny, you've got nothing to worry about. Now, this was a mistake. You know, I made a promise that this would be done in a day, and now it's done. It's not our problem anymore.
And what happens if you wake up tomorrow and you remember something else?
Then I'll forget it.
And the next day?
I'll forget it. It doesn't matter, Pen. You're my life now. You and Charlie.
Never forget it, Des. So I guess we're going with you.
Hmm.
So at this point, like, I do think that, like, you should be terrified about the fact that, like, Ben has said, I'm going to kill your daughter. Penelope, is it? Very pointedly.
Mm-hmm.
Who is pointedly? And then...
that's the guy in the mine in the Dharma Initiative who's, like, pointing at where Saul Drillman should go.
Exactly. And you also know that Ben is in L.A., so, like, no... So I do remember in the real time being like, oh, shit. So there was like the tension of Desmond and Penny. As you mentioned before, there is like the tension of like the show does build that. And I guess like your mileage varies on whether or not that's good or bad.
Right, and there's also, again, this like repeated insistence from Desmond of like, I'm done. I'm out. And you know, screenwriting 101, like the minute they say they're out, they're not out, you know?
Yeah, just when I thought I was out. Yeah, exactly. But she, like, Penny is just the best.
She sees through Desmond's bullshit immediately, and it's so great, right? That he's, like, coming up with this lie, and when you think that there's gonna be another entire lie to follow, Penny's like, nope, you're lying, tell me the truth. And Desmond's like, okay, I have to do this. She's like, God, I hate what you're doing right now, but fine, I'm gonna go with you. Like, damn, Penny's a great ride or die, seriously.
Yes. So I love Penny in this episode. I think she's amazing. I love that she's like, at this point, it's like, Desmond, you can do your crazy shit, but you have to include me.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to go off and do this stuff because you think it's morally right, the reasons we've run into trouble before is because, like, you didn't feel like you could share that with me. But, like, I can freaking handle it. I can absolutely handle
it. Remember when I chartered, like, an entire boat and a couple of Portuguese scientists, one of which looked like your buddy Jack, to find you? Like, I'm fine being in on the weirdness. You just gotta clue me in.
You gotta let me in on the weirdness. So she's in. I love that from Penny. All right. Final sound of the episode and effectively final scene of the episode. There will be, like, one tiny little bit afterwards that doesn't really... is not really conducive to sound. One last big conversation... from John Locke and Richard Alpert, humongously significant, even if it doesn't, like, fully feel that way in the moment. Really, so much of Lost happens because of what happens right now. Let's listen in. Sound number 8.
I gave you this.
Yes.
After you were shot in the leg and I wandered out of the jungle to patch you up?
That's right.
And why don't I remember, well, any of this?
Because it hasn't happened yet.
I'm not sure what you're expecting me to say, John Locke.
I expect you to tell me how to get off the island.
That's very privileged information. Why would I share that with you?
Because you told me that I had something very important to do once I get there. And because I'm your leader.
You're my leader.
That's what you told me.
Look, I... certainly don't want to contradict myself, but we have a very specific process for selecting our leadership, and it starts at a very, very young age.
All right. All right. What year is it right now?
It's 1954.
All right. May 30th, 1956. 2 years from now, that's the day I'm born. Tustin, California. And if you don't believe me, I suggest you come and visit me. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
It's about to happen again. You need to tell me now, Richard. How do I get off the island? Please, tell me!
Oh, so wild.
Yeah, so we have a very specific process for selecting our leadership. It happens at a young age. Locke realizes he hasn't been born yet in this time. He is 2 years away from being born. He tells Richard Alpert exactly where to find him when he is born. We know that Richard Alpert goes. We know that Richard Alpert continues to check in on John Locke for the rest of his life. We know that there is this great, tremendous interest in John Locke as a potential leader of the others, that the Matthew Abaddons of the world are going to come to him long before he ever goes to the island to encourage him on the walkabout. Is there an argument, Mike, that Oceanic 815 crashes because John Locke is on it and because all of this has to happen?
I mean, I guess, you know, does John Locke kickstart this idea of candidates for Jacob is an interesting thought experiment. Like, how old is this candidate system in place? Could it have been Richard Alpert goes back to Jacob and says, you're not going to believe what just happened. This guy named John Locke came to us, said he's from the future, gave me this compass, said all these things about like what the island could do. And it makes Jacob think, oh, this could be an interesting guy to take my place one day. And so he begins this process and starts to begin the process of specifically bringing a bunch of candidates together on a plane. That could possibly lead to you know, one thing happening. Ironically enough, in an episode that focuses on a guy that ends up crashing Oceanic 815. And so in that regard, you know, much like some of the Oceanic 6 are responsible for those poor gawkers aboard a Jira, John Locke is responsible for maybe some of those other people crashing on the island as well. I love it. I think that we've faced the idea of a bootstrap paradox before in The Constant, right, where Faraday tells Desmond to go find him, so that Desmond can tell Faraday to go tell Desmond in the future about this type of stuff. But this is like an outright explicit reference to it, of John Locke saying, okay, I know that you visit me, so I'm telling you to go visit me now. And it's right. It's one of those really fun things that Lost does with time travel in this season. And this is before we've explicitly also established these rules of whatever happened, happened. We're still in this fun, nebulous area before any rules are explicitly stated. And so we can have some fun in this ball pit. And that's what we get right here with John Locke essentially like guaranteeing, kickstarting the besieged yet important life that he leads up until crashing onto the island.
Yeah, it's I love it, Mike. I really, really, really do. Because, like, John Locke tells Alpert to go. Jacob finds out from Alpert at this point, probably, like, yo, this happened. It's real. Like, yeah, he was born. That happened. Jacob's probably suddenly like, fascinating. Let's keep tabs on him. In the 1970s, like, they are going to, you know, come to find out about Sawyer's connection to John Locke. Richard Alpert and Sawyer are going to have their tete-a-tete in LaFleur. A couple years after that is when Jack and Hurley and Kate, when they're going to come back and they're going to be on the island, they're going to blend in. You probably find out at this point through them if there are people who are like listening in. Certainly a smoke monster is able to, like, you know, be a little more incognito and pick up on some of this stuff, that this John Locke guy that everybody now has on their radar is associated with these people. He's also dead. That might give the monster some ideas. And so these guys having to come here, Jacob himself is probably seeing endgame stuff, right? Like, this is why, like, the chess is happening. And, like, this is going to be, Jacob is going to have to, like, go off island and touch these people on the shoulders and summon them to the island and all of this stuff. So, like, Locke doing what he does here, I think there's a real argument that it is the, you know, we're pushing the snowball down the hill that's going to turn into this avalanche of everything else that happens on Lost.
So does that mean that, is Jin going to be the Quan in the cave then? Does that, because Jin was back in the 70s and Sun was in the future. So maybe,
yeah,
because Jin was back, you know, then, he's like, oh yeah, I know this guy, Jin. He's the Quan that'll, and surely there'll be not be another Quan that comes onto the island.
It's interesting. I think that could make sense. And, like, also at this point, you know, the whole, like, why doesn't Kate even get, like, a numbers number? Like, you know, she's crossed off because she's, you're a mother. I didn't think you'd want the job, which is amazing. just on a lot of levels.
God damn it, Jacob.
I know. But, like, from his logic at that point, like, even then, he knows, because she's come back, that she's looking for Aaron's mother. Like, if they've got the intelligence on these people, if they, and, you know, we know that the others have, like, deep dossiers on these people, what are they able to start, like, putting together now? Is Jacob, like, able to, like, piece some of this stuff together, that, like, is, that's why she's got, like, an off number? But Hurley and Locke and Sawyer and Saeed and Jack and one of the Quans being Jin, like, all of that would track as far as people who, from this moment forward, because of John Locke's conversation with Richard and everything that Richard's able to find out from there, and then the people who are traveling in time who are connected to Locke explicitly to Richard Alpert, right? Like, it would make sense that these would all be people like, this is it. Jacob's like, this is it. I'm smart enough to know that Smokey McSmokerton, who's been trying to kill me forever, who's been looking for a loophole, is going to see this as a loophole, is probably right if we don't play this right, but this is the moment. This is where it's happening. So I think that this is like, this is a foundational moment for all of Lost, this conversation. And it is like relatively, it is like relatively low key. Like it's played pretty chill given the severity of what's happening here in this conversation between John and Richard.
Well, especially considering this is not how the episode ends. Like I think they wanted to build in something more climactic. So it ends with, oh, something's happening with Charlotte. It turns out to be, Charlotte's not, she definitely is not doing well. We're going to be a couple episodes removed from her actually dying, but I could tell in true Losty fashion that they wanted to end with something big. But I absolutely agree. If you're going with like pure just seminality of the moment, it's got to be this. Because as you mentioned before, this is the snowball to kickstart the giant avalanche, as it were, the small grain of dirt to start the mudslide. This is just Charlotte sort of like accelerating in the time sickness.
Yeah. Yeah. She's it's going poorly. It is the final thing of the episode. I think Charlotte convulsing and falling to the ground, like this is sort of like legendary Lost stuff. Maybe not for like the best reasons, but like now we know it's starting to get real.
Yeah. Though again, well, it'll be a couple of episodes, before she really ends up looking a little bit worse for wear. But in this moment, at least you're like, oh, okay, Charlotte's dead. I mean, she sort of gets the visibility spike, right? Like she has Daniel declare his love for her. Of course, that would be a good moment to kill her off.
Correct. So that's the episode. That's Jughead. I think Jughead is really provocative, has a lot of stuff going on that makes you think, a lot of stuff that when you think about it really hard, like you can relate to Charlotte bleeding out the nose by the end of it. I'm giving it a 3.9, just shy of the fours, but I really do appreciate this episode. It's like almost like an appreciation boost, is I think like the significance of Jughead is not lost on me, and it has a bunch of really great scenes in there. But if you're a little lower than that, or if you're higher than that, like I wouldn't quibble with you in either direction.
Yeah, so I'm gonna say this. I give it a 3.7. I give The Lie a 3.6, and I like this slightly more based on what you said, because I think the on-island stuff is just so cool. I don't think we've really had as big of an episode on Lost so far that has just been so great at setting up so many big things in both the chronological future and the show's future. And so Jughead does feel like an actually really important episode of Lost. I don't know if the quality of the episode necessarily measures up to that. There's some really fun stuff in here, but like I said, I am not a fan of the Desmond stuff in season 5 especially, and I feel like when you boil down the plot in this episode especially, like, you think you're eating the steaks, but there are no steaks. You're just eating nothing. It's invisible and that you're carving your knife into when you know everything that happens. As much as I love Desmond, I sort of worry for him running frenetically around Great Britain for really nothing at the end of the day. So I think the good very much outweighs the bad, though. We got, a good span of things. Lowest, I think, was like a 3.3, but the highest, as we mentioned before, was a 4.1. So again, I think we're sticking in this very, like, solid mid to high threes for Lost season 5 so far. It's been a very strong 3 episode start.
For sure. All right, let's get into the feedback. This is from Dallin Servo. Dallin writes in, how much could Jacob tell Richard about Locke if he went and asked Jacob shortly after meeting Locke? I think that's the thing. Probably not a lot.
Yeah, Jacob doesn't travel through time. I don't think he could.
No. And I think that what's also interesting here is that John Locke blinks out of existence in front of Richard. So he makes an impression.
Yeah. Like he comes in saying, like, I'm your leader. He's bloviating. This guy probably thinks he, like, I don't know, got knocked in the head pretty hard while he was on the island. But Locke proves himself by giving a compass to Richard, talking about time travel, and then literally disappearing in front of him. Like, hell of a Correct. Magic act.
Correct. So how much could Jacob tell him? Probably what he tells him is, oh, well, that's a very interesting story. He told you his birthday? He told you where to be when he's born? Well, that's 2 years from now. Go visit him in 2 years.
Yeah.
That's probably what Jacob says, and that, I think, starts a lot of stuff. From the great Snorri Jonsson writes in and says, I just started watching Chronologically Lost for the first time a few days ago, and seeing this episode through the eyes of Richard is so interesting. Seeing him arriving on the island in 1867, meeting Locke in 56, and then visiting him again And then again, around 1960, it makes the show feel so complete and circular watching it like that. I got to say, Mike, I am starting to get a little bit interested in checking out Chronologically Lost.
I was going to say, I would love to actually petition the Hatchlings if you all watched it. I mean, there might be a universe that exists out there that maybe we do a series where Josh and I go through Chronologically Lost and do maybe what, like, I don't know, like 40 minutes at a time or something.
I have no idea how it would work.
But if you have ideas and you think it's like an idea that might be worth pursuing, absolutely let us know. We are all ears.
Let us know. We are more than just ears, but we also
I am one giant ear.
Wide open. From Av. Av writes in, why does Richard believe Faraday? He's deeply suspicious of him until he plays the I love her card. Are we sure that Richard is smart? He seems to almost blindly believe everyone who tells him anything.
Wow. Av coming in with the fire arrows. Right. I mean, listen, I think that Richard is fine believing in others because when he crash landed on the island, a plume of black smoke appeared to him. And then anthropomorphized version of good came to him and gave him everlasting life. I think I'd believe in a lot of stuff if that happened to me personally.
I think so as well. Daniel Brennan asks, is Richard the leader of the others in 1954?
Yeah, I would imagine so. So then I guess that begs the question, because we talk about sort of like the abdication of leadership, right? That like, when does Richard become the consigliere and sort of step back in the leadership position? It's got to happen at some point in these intervening years, because when we come back into the 70s, then Ellie and Widmore are sort of like the dual leaders in the 70s. When does Albert sort of like take that step back?
Right, yeah. Or maybe there's another leader here who's like out on a mission, doesn't come
maybe, back. Maybe it was that third soldier that Locke killed.
Cunningham, Mr. Cunningham. From Eric Divestein, happy birthday. Not yet. It's coming up, though. A couple months.
Happy birthday. You cannot say that we didn't wish you a happy birthday.
No, it's coming up. I've got it on the calendar. Eric writes in, why do you think the U.S. military chose this island for their hydrogen bomb test? Do they know something about the island, or was it random? Eric, don't mistake coincidence for fate.
I mean, it could be a thing where we have certainly seen, especially in a lot of like superhero canon, how the military or the government knows secret things about paranormal activity. Maybe they have it on the map quite literally and wanted to test out some stuff. Maybe it just happened to be an island that appeared in the South Pacific around this time.
And let's do one more. This is actually from the Post Show Recaps patron Discord, where, as Brendan Fitzpatrick calls him, Eric, our bomb guy, Eric, who has a lot of expertise in the field, wrote in with some thoughts about Jughead the Bomb, not the episode. So Eric with the expertise. We love it when we hear from the experts. Eric writes in, Faraday's correct in that the best course of action is to bury the Jughead and cover it with lead and or concrete. There's only three things that will protect you from radiation: time, distance, and shielding. Time equals minimizing the amount of time you spend in proximity to the source. Distance equals increasing the distance between you and the source, because gamma rays can travel a few kilometers, getting weaker as they go. And shielding means put material that will absorb or scatter the radiation between you and the source. Lead is the commonly used shielding, but I doubt a significant amount of lead is sitting around on the island. Concrete would work, but you probably need thickness in the ballpark of 5 to 8 feet, which is a lot. Water would also work, and if they could get it into the ocean, that might be the best play.
Mm.
Either way, if it stays on land, it's going to contaminate local animal and plant life, along with the groundwater. So if children could be born on the island, they would eventually start being born with a third eye, or mutant powers.
Interesting. So yeah, I mean, I guess ideally burying it in the ocean would have solved a lot of problems. Was it just a matter of mobility, that because it was in the mesa and it was so far inland, they didn't really have the means to transport it cautiously without setting it off, without an arse type yelling at them, right? Of like, it sweats, you can't move it.
Yeah. So they're told to bury it underground and put it in concrete. But we know, so they buried it. It's buried underneath the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Is where the bomb is ultimately placed. Is it like just like covered in concrete, or is it just like kind of like hanging out underground? I believe it was just sort of
hanging out. I'm trying to remember in the incident when they break through the wall. I think it's just like almost sitting there, a la something out of Indiana Jones, like on a pedestal.
Yeah, they buried it underground. underneath the barracks. Maybe it being underneath the barracks, some of these freaky deaky mutations are starting to occur.
Maybe that's why the superpowers were sort of pushed along. It wasn't island technology. It's just radiation.
Let's get to the MVP, LVPs. Mike, you've got three MVPs. I've got two. I've got three LVPs. You've got two. It looks like we have, once again, five different people getting MVP points.
Ooh, look at this. Yes, come through diversity. I'm going to start with Daniel Faraday. I complimented him throughout this episode on Island, at least. He does a really good job, like, staying cool. We talked about how Daniel Faraday isn't really great under interrogation, especially when he's trying to lie. This might be the exception. He does a great job of posturing as someone from the military. He finds out all this information, and he does, you know, place some ideas in people's heads that are going to germinate. He's able to confess his love for Charlotte. This might be an all-time episode for Daniel Faraday.
Very good episode for Daniel Faraday. I'm giving a point to Desmond, despite what we said about Desmond's season 5 story arc. First of all, he looks exceptional. but also, like, you know, he's being the hero that we love. He, you know, he knows, he feels it in his bones that he has to go and do something about this, that this was a real memory. He can't just let these people suffer. He has to do something. So that's the Desmond we know and love. And also his confrontation with Widmore is such a long time coming that I got to give him some props.
Well, let me give a point then to his constant, Penny, who really is his constant in this episode, saying, Desmond, what are you doing? Stop it. This is not good. And she, every single syllable that comes out of her mouth, Josh, is 100% correct. And so, like, despite her having to go along with Desmond in all of this, I just got to go with Penny for being so right all the time.
I will give an MVP point to John Locke.
It's been a while.
It's been a minute, it feels like. John Locke getting a point here. Locke with, like, the bravado to just charge into Alpert's camp, and he's able to capture Alpert's attention really well. Very smart move of, like, Jacob sent me. And then, if he didn't give Richard the information he gave him, we, I think, wouldn't have lost.
Yeah,
is a possibility.
Thank you, John, you know? Locke. So,
thanks, John. I appreciate it. Maybe ultimately a little bit bad for him, but by involving himself in this loop and creating this destiny for himself, he's also kind of creating this shared destiny with all of the other characters, which is going to save the island from the monster's ultimate evil plan. So John Locke is damning himself, but kind of saving the day in this moment. I think that there's a read where that's the case.
You said other characters. Let me give my final MVP point to a literal other character. We mentioned her before, but really good Juliet episode. She is once again serving herself to be the coolest head, no matter what time period that she's in. She's able to speak Latin and serve as the go-between. She's an incredibly valuable resource throughout this episode.
Yeah. LVP's time. All of my LVPs go to others, actually. Cunningham dies. That's easy. We break his neck. Cunningham scores an LVP point. Eloise, I feel like Eloise probably should have, like, remembered Faraday and this whole situation a little bit better, and, like, I'm, like, giving her, like, a preemptive LVP point for shooting.
So you're waiting for, like, the variable, like, this point will come back around.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like, you know, I like the character. I just, this is sloppy stuff. And then Widmore, flashback Widmore, time travel Widmore.
Yeah, no,
modern Widmore is actually kind of great in this one.
Little a-hole Widmore is so bad he's good in this episode, purposely so. Like, this is definitely one of those season one Sawyer, like, this is just a bad character, and so we almost, like, relish in giving them an LVP point. I'm gonna give him one as well for that very reason. He's, again, if Penny, everything she says in this episode is 100% right, everything young Charles Widmore says in this episode is 100% wrong. And so I love that balance as well, right, that his very own daughter counteracts him here. But I sort of alluded to it before, I'm going to counteract my own MVP point for Faraday by giving him an LVP point, because he does put Teresa Spencer in a coma.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's an argument that, like, they're colleagues, they both, like, you know, get, like, messed up from this, but we don't know the full story. I'm not going to fight you hard on it. Especially because if you had not taken away that point, then he would be tied for first place this season with David Reyes and Carmen Reyes. And currently, they remain the MVPs. Ooh,
what
of season five.
If Faraday had tied with them, does that make him their new son?
It's possible, right?
You have to adopt me?
Yeah. I think, actually, you have to adopt me? I think those are the rules.
Mr. Tron, Lady Tron, your new name is Mr. Time?
Mr. Time? All right, so those are the MVPs. Widmore and Frogert are bringing up the rear.
Widmore's getting -4 in 3 episodes. He might be approaching Anthony Cooper levels in season 5.
I'll be curious to know. He will certainly, this is not the last time he's getting dinged up, if not this season, then long term. So we'll see where all of that goes. Next week, Mike, it's The Little Prince.
Yeah. It's The Little Prince. I think you talked about how maybe this episode was perceived, at least initially, as a bit of a moving the chess pieces episode on island. That's what The Little Prince is off island. Because I think this is when, like, we start to get the plan, right, of let's get the Oceanic Six together. Everything sort of is caught up in who's Norton and Agostini working for. All this tension behind Kate and Aaron. We get a little bit of on-island stuff. I think this is where we actually, speaking of Aaron, this is where we go back to the birth of Aaron. I would argue maybe the strongest part of this episode is the ending. But that being said, look, Kate episodes, I have gotten more enjoyment out of them on the whole than I think I would have before we started this kooky experiment. So I'm happy to see if that's another case here.
I'm excited to check it out. The Little Prince, that's going to be in your podcast feed on June 4th, or if you're a patron of Post Show Recaps, June 2nd, consider signing up, patreon.com/postshowrecap. Sign up next week. June 1st, perfect time to sign up for post-show recaps on Patreon. We charge at the start of the month, so you're going to get your bang for your buck. You get to, if you join at the $5 level, you get great podcasts. Mm-hmm. If you sign up at the $10 level, you get those great podcasts in an exceptional community in the post-show recaps Patreon Discord. If you sign up at the $15 level, you get cool swag. You can get a Wiggler's Wombats hat. Did you know that?
Wow.
You sign up at that $15 level. So those are the tiers. You shall be giving us tears of joy should you choose to sign up.
Can you call it that? Tears of joy?
Tears of joy. Yeah, I just did.
There we go.
Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Next week, also, the launch of the aforementioned 24 podcast, Worst Day Ever, a 24 Season 1 recap podcast. Coming your way in 24-minute intervals. The first episode will be longer. I think the second episode, too. But other than that, we are aiming for 24-minute episodes of the podcast. Really fun, very stressful, really enjoyable. I think you'll enjoy
it. There's essentially a bomb in the corner, yeah, right, that's ticking down.
It's great. But like the goal is like so much more dangerous than what we were doing with Lost, which was untenable, that like this, like we have to do it. And also, like, I have a co-host in the legendary Emily Fox, who is my Worst Day Ever 24 podcast co-host, who, unlike you, Mike, is not going to tolerate it if we go over the exceeded time limit. Like, she doesn't want to go past 24 minutes. So, like, we have a hard out. It's going to be really, really, really fun. So I hope that you all enjoy it. We will have that podcast out. I believe that's going to be launching on June 1st. So keep an eye out in your podcast feeds for that one to drop. Mike Bloom, you got those Bloom files going.
Got the Bloom files going. We're working our way towards the end of season 4. Again, if we're talking about time traveling and accessing repressed memories, got a couple of those fun little things, as well as two bouts of wrongful accusations of murder going on the Bloom files. But also, if you're a fan of the reality TV, specifically of The Survivor, you're going to want to be checking out what's coming your way first week of June as well. Not only is it the premiere of Worst Day Ever, a 24 rewatch podcast, but also the premiere of Survivor South Africa, Immunity Island. If you have had your ear tuned to the ground whatsoever, Shannon, Gus, and I have been covering this series out the wazoo, including a bunch of stuff in the preseason. I should have another podcast out this weekend as well. And who knows, maybe in a few weeks' time, the very person I'm talking to might show up on the podcast, washing up on the beach a la Jin in 1988.
Who can say? If you were able to time travel, you might be able to get some further clarity on that one. But it was, you never know.
You never know.
You never know. That's what we always say here on Down the Hatch. Send in your feedback, downthehatch@postshowrecaps.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter at Round Howard, at A Mike Bloom Type, or in the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Mike Bloom, we'll talk next week about The Little Prince. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye bye.
6 Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.